Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Next 4 Years podcast. My name is Connor Payton, and I'll be your host. This show features in-depth interviews and conversations with friends, coworkers, and other young adults regarding life post-college. You can kind of look at it as your playbook to life after college. Now, I want to take a moment to thank everybody who has listened to this podcast so far. I really appreciate the support. I really like the feedback that people send me via my email or text message, and I hope you continue to do so. You can reach me on Twitter also at ConnorPayton22 or my email address, ConnorPayton@gmail.com. I'm always open for feedback and would love to hear from you. Now, if I could just ask for a favor, if you like the show, please go rate and review it on iTunes. That really helps other listeners find the show, and then we can continue to produce content and get the show out to more listeners. This episode is with a very old friend of mine, Danielle Beckerman. Danielle attended UC Berkeley before finishing her degree at California Lutheran and is now in grad school at CLU. We get into some sensitive but important topics in this conversation that I don't want to ramble on too much about here in this intro, but I think that you will get a lot out of this conversation. I certainly did. It's a very inspiring story that Danielle has to share, and I think that you will really enjoy it and learn a lot from what she has to say. So I'm not going to ramble on too much. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy this episode with Danielle Beckerman.
This is the Next 4 Years with Connor Payton.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Next 4 Years podcast. I'm joined by a special guest today, Danielle Beckerman. Danielle, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I am out here in Texas like normal, and you're in Oak Park, California, where we met many years ago. I was kind of thinking about this the other day, and we've known each other for a really long time. I think 13 years now.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah.
And for the regular listeners, they'll know who you are because I've told the story actually on the podcast a little bit, but you were my first ever girlfriend back in the sixth grade.
I was, and you were mine.
Right. How did that all go down exactly? Because I didn't actually ask you out, right? We did the typical sixth grade thing.
Yeah, we had a third party involved.
Right, that's how it always goes. I asked our mutual friend if Danielle might be interested in going out with me, whatever that meant back in sixth grade.
I remember it was on Outdoor Ed, and Callie McKenna was like, "So I think you have a secret admirer." I was like, "All right, I'll see what that's about."
Had we ever even talked before then?
I don't think so, to be honest. I don't think so.
Well, for one, I'm going to go ahead and congratulate myself on just going for it. And two, that just really summarizes what middle school dating was like in a way. We kind of formulated a friend group after that. Yeah. And everyone just kind of always interdated the entire time.
Yeah, it was a lot of dating among friends and a lot of breakups and people being upset, and it was quite the group of friends.
But that's not abnormal whatsoever, I don't think.
No, not at all.
That's not really even unique to just middle school. I feel like you see that a lot in high school as well. Like all of the drama kids will date each other, you know, that sort of thing. But that's not the case for you, because you ended up dating one of my best friends after started in high school, correct?
Yeah, we started dating, Blake and I started dating the end of our sophomore year of high school.
End of your sophomore year, so that's about 2.5 years of high school, four years of college, and 2 years out of college now. So what is that, 8 years?
Yeah, it'll be 8 years in June.
Wow, that is the longest relationship I've ever had on this podcast, and I've had a married couple.
Yeah, I listened to that one. It was really interesting to hear about that.
Yeah, for the listeners who don't know, Danielle is dating one of my good friends. Played basketball with Blake, actually, back in high school. And He stole away my middle school girlfriend.
And, whisked me away.
Here we are now, and I moved away to Texas, but you are still in California. And you are currently in grad school, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am.
And what are you studying? You're at California Lutheran.
Yeah, I'm at California Lutheran University. It's in Thousand Oaks, so it's about 15 minutes from where I live, which I'm living at home with my parents. And I'm studying psychology, so I'll end up being a marriage and family therapist when I'm all done.
Wow, I'm really interested in all of that. I'd love to talk more about that, but what would a managing family therapist do exactly? Is that inner family dynamics?
It can be. It's a pretty general kind of field. It kind of sounds like you would just be doing marriage and family therapy, but you could do couples therapy, you could do family therapy, individual. A lot of times people work in treatment centers for all different kinds of different issues, substance abuse or eating disorders. You could have a private practice. So really anything that you want to do with it. Whenever someone says, you know, I'm going to go to my therapist, it's usually a marriage and family therapist.
Okay. And what got you interested in this? Is this what you studied in undergrad? And where did you kind of find your passion for this topic?
Yeah, I've always been really interested in just the brain and how it works and why people do what they do and how people interact. And I did study psychology in undergrad and I loved it. So when I graduated or when I was coming to graduate, I still wasn't, you know, I didn't take any time in between, but I still was like, okay, what do I do? Do I want to go straight into grad school? But I figured I know that I love it and it's what I want to do. So I might as well do it now rather than having to go back later.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with psychology as a bachelor's degree, there's not that much you can do with it. So you kind of have to go back to grad school.
My dad is actually a psychology undergrad major.
Oh, and, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he is. And he works in the stock market.
Yeah.
So there you go. He says it's perfect for that, but, you know, I guess that kind of goes along exactly with your point.
Yeah, it can be applied to anything, I guess. It's just how people relate.
So my roommate is a grad student. He's not a psychology major. He's a biochemistry grad school major, whatever. Is it a major in grad school?
I don't know, to be honest. People degree. Always ask me, and I'm like, I don't know. It's just what I'm studying.
I think candidate. But he's a biochemistry candidate for his doctorate. I think right. There we go.
Yeah.
So he is in grad school. So I kind of know how this works because I live with somebody who does it. But he has classes and he also spends a lot of time actually working as an employee in the biochemistry lab at the school. Mm-hmm. Do you have to work or do any special projects in addition to classes?
Yeah, I do. So the program I'm in is to get my master's, and it's a two-year program. So I'm coming towards the end of my first year. And then starting in August, we'll start, it's called our practicum. And Cal Lutheran has its own counseling center, which is great. So in the second year of my program, I'll start to see clients through the counseling center. And that's how we kind of get, I don't remember how many, but I think it's like 200 something hours to graduate, and then after I graduate, I'll need 3,000 hours to become licensed.
And so after you graduate, when you're doing those 3,000 hours, are you just every day making appointments with clients? And are you overseen in these, or is this your own special project?
So while you get your hours, you have a supervisor and you work kind of under their license. My hope is to work in a treatment center. And, yeah, it's kind of like you just go to work every day as if you are already licensed and you do whatever it is depending on where you're working and you're supervised. And then once you have all those hours, you take, you know, the big exam to get licensed. And then you can practice on your own without working under someone else's license.
How does the whole client-therapist privilege and secrecy work while you're being overseen?
Yeah, it's definitely a thing. They have to sign a I'm forgetting what it's called. If my professors heard me right now, they'd be like, "How could you forget?" Oh, informed consent.
Okay.
So they sign an informed consent form, and that will tell them that, you know, obviously their therapist is going to know all the information and that their therapist has a supervisor who also is going to have access to everything. So they know that it's going to be talked about with at least one other person, but they sign that they're okay with it.
That's really interesting. I think that I would definitely be okay with that, because I'm all about, you know, people learning and you know, producing more help for people around the world. Yeah. And I think therapists do a great job of that. And it's really great that you're interested in that. Now, I can't remember if you already said this. Is this what you studied in undergraduate as well?
Yeah, psychology in general. I didn't know what if I wanted to, you know, do clinical psychology or what, but psychology in general is what I studied in undergrad, yeah.
Very cool. So you started off at high school in Oak Park with me, and mm-hmm. you were a very, very talented student because you got into one of the best universities in the country, UC Berkeley. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of tell me about the initial, I guess, high school experience of getting into that school and kind of the joy or excitement that you might have felt, or if you didn't feel that, whatever kind of experience that was of getting in?
Yeah, you know, I was the that high school student that was just constantly like one big stress ball. Like everything was the biggest deal ever, everything. And I remember when I first started high school at Oak Park, hearing a senior talk about UC Berkeley, and he was like, yeah, you know, it's the best UC. And I got in, and that's where I want to go. And I had never been to UC Berkeley. I didn't really know anything, but as a freshman in high school, I decided like, that's where I'm going when I graduate. I want to go to Berkeley.
We should specify, for the listeners who don't know, Oak Park, California is near Los Angeles. It's in Southern California.
Yeah. So I figured, Berkeley's in Northern California. I'll still be in California, but I won't be too far. And I was very set on the name of Berkeley and that, you know, it's a great school and all these things. So I worked very, very hard in high school, studied a lot, studied instead of going out, and stressed out a lot. So when I got in, I actually got in, though, for the spring semester when I was admitted. So when I initially found out, I was actually kind of disappointed because I felt like, oh, I didn't really get in. I like sort of got in at the time. Now I realize like, yeah, I just got into Berkeley. But I remember I was auditioning for the high school we went to did plays where the students kind of direct the plays. And so I was auditioning for one of those, and I was waiting to go in for my audition, and I got the email, and I was just thrilled.
That's really great. And just to kind of throw in my own two cents, I got second semester at USC.
Oh, you did?
I did. And USC was my dream school kind of growing up. Mm-hmm. However, when I had walked on campus at TCU, I had totally fallen in love with it. And I really knew that was where I was going to go all along. But I don't know, my whole thing, when I got second semester at USC, I was like so bitter and angry towards them.
Yeah.
And I was just like, yeah, I'm not waiting around for a whole semester to get in. Whereas like, who cares, right?
Like, yeah, like you got in.
Yeah. So, I mean, congratulations to you for being more mature than I was. I ran away to Texas. And
yeah, I was definitely very upset. But Berkeley had a great program for their spring admits. It was called like fall program for freshmen, where I was able to go there in the fall, and they have an extension campus, and I was able to rush and do all the normal activities. The only difference was where I went to class was not the big Berkeley campus, it was the extension one, but then everything transferred. So that's why I was kind of okay with it once I figured out, because I was like, oh, it's basically, you know, the same thing.
Right. You got the initial college experience of moving away and mm-hmm. being new when everyone else is new. And that's really important, I think. So you mentioned that you went through Rush. What sorority did you join?
I was in Pi Phi.
Pi Phi. Were you involved at all with it while you were there?
I don't know if I'd say I was involved. So I was only at Berkeley. I left Berkeley, I think, March of the second semester. So after doing Rush and getting initiated and all that, that doesn't even happen and takes so long for all of it to happen. So by the time I was like fully in the sorority, I ended up leaving anyways. So yeah, I wouldn't say I was involved, but I guess the friends I made while I was there were through my sorority. And then I lived in the sorority house this part of the second semester that I was there.
Okay. So you were getting into it, but you mentioned that you left. Why did you end up leaving?
So when I went to, after I got into Berkeley my senior year, I went and I visited it with my mom. And I remember thinking when I was there, like, wow, this is, you know, such a beautiful campus and I can't believe I got in. But it kind of like kind of what you talked about with when you walked onto the TCU campus and you were like, this is where I, you know, this is where I'm going to go. A lot of people kind of explain that when they talk about when they pick their school. And I never really felt that. I was like, well, this is where I'm going because this is where I plan to go. But I don't, it felt kind of weird. And then when I was there that first semester, I just, you know, I just didn't like it. I couldn't find my place. I was dealing with some depression and anxiety. And then my second semester, I developed an eating disorder. And that's why I ended up coming home the middle of the second semester so abruptly like I did, rather than finishing off my whole freshman year.
So it was, in the end, you knew it wasn't a good fit for you, but it was a medical reason that made you decide to leave finally.
Yeah, and when I left, I wasn't planning on leaving finally. I was planning on going back, but that didn't end up happening. But yeah, the reason why I left was medical.
I would imagine that leaving a school that you had kind of planned on going to for so long and a school that you had worked so hard to get into was something really difficult emotionally to deal with. Can you kind of talk about your feelings upon leaving? And I know you were going through something big at the time, but maybe the more emotional side first.
Yeah, it was definitely hard. And I feel like I didn't deal with the fact that I had left my, you know, this big dream school actually until last year when I saw all my people I started there with, you know, the girls in the sorority and the different people I met graduating from Berkeley. And I was, you know, back home in Oak Park and I still had a year left before I got my bachelor's. I was behind because of going to treatment and stuff. And that's when I was kind of felt that like, wow, I left and I didn't like what would have happened there. And it was such a great school. And now I'm graduating from a school that has kind of a less of a prestigious name, which now I don't really care about that. But yeah, I mean, it was tough and everything that came with it was tough for sure.
You mentioned that the eating disorder was what kind of took you away in the end. Mm-hmm. What kind of treatment did you end up seeking to help yourself go through that? And this is really important. So I just kind of want to hear about, you know, what you were going through, what kind of emotions you had behind it, and what you did to fix it.
Yeah, a lot of people struggle and a lot of people don't know that people are struggling. So I'm always happy to kind of share my story. So I didn't really know that I have developed an eating disorder. You know, I gained the normal weight that people gain when they go to college from drinking and eating pizza and whatever.
I had that too.
it's very common. It's just, I guess, how you deal with it. So that was really hard for me, and I decided to kind of go on a diet, and I went on a juice cleanse, and I kind of never brought food back in, and I just really stopped eating really abruptly. And my parents came to visit me for Parents Weekend for my sorority, and they didn't really recognize me, and they didn't think eating disorder because it was so quick. They thought maybe I'm sick or they don't know what was happening, and then they realized I wasn't eating. And about a week later, my dad called me and he said, we're bringing you home, you have to come home. And then like 2 days after I came home, I was in the hospital at UCLA. They have, it's actually shut down now, but they had an eating disorder unit in the hospital there. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where my treatment journey started. I was in the hospital for about 5 weeks at UCLA. And then I went straight to a residential program in La Habra, California. So anyways, I was in residential treatment, which is kind of when people think about treatment for substance abuse or eating disorders, that's what you imagine. You know, it's a house with, there were six girls there, and I was there for 3 months. And then I got transferred to kind of a transitional living home near where I live in Thousand Oaks, California. And I was doing more treatment, living in kind of a halfway house for another 4 months, I believe. So it was about 8 months that I was in treatment, just kind of disconnected from the world.
Wow, 8 months is a really long time to kind of go through something like that. Mm-hmm. What kind of activities were you doing while in treatment? I'm just trying to educate myself. And as much as you can share, because I do know some of this might be private. But just what kind of treatments do you go through while kind of going through this in the different houses that you were in?
Yeah, so the first place at UCLA was very much just a hospital setting, just getting me to a place where I wasn't going to die. You know, monitoring me medically, getting me to eat again. And that was mainly the focus there was medical, getting me to a place where I was stable enough to not have to be in a hospital. And then after that, it's a lot of therapy. You know, that's kind of what you do in treatment is, you know, we always joke like our days are like talk, eat, talk, sleep. Mm-hmm. It's group therapy, individual therapy, family therapy, talking about, you know, why I developed an eating disorder, what purpose it served for me. I had anorexia, and what's very common with anorexia is a very perfectionistic personality, which I've always been that way. Control, feeling like I need to take up less space in the world, feeling like I'm not important. So things like that were what I dealt with. And then also learning how to eat again. It kind of warps your whole mind. You forget how to eat and what food is. And so learning that food isn't scary, that I need it, that it's good, that, you know, learning how to just kind of live a life of freedom where, you know, this eating disorder voice in your head doesn't constantly tell you what you can and can't do. And it's kind of like living in a prison. So it's learning how to kind of break out of that. And I mean, it's a lifelong journey. I'm doing great in my recovery. Mm-hmm. But it's something, you know, it's been about, it'll be 5 years in August that I've been out of treatment. And it's something I still go to therapy, and it's something I still always continue to work on.
Yeah, you said that you've been doing great in your recovery. What kind of check marks, I guess, do they look for maybe mm-hmm. in recovery? Or what have you noticed about yourself that maybe some strengths that you know you have now that, you know, I would imagine going through something this difficult, you really learn about a lot about yourself and things you can, you know, tackle. And this is something that you've built up. Can you kind of talk about that and maybe the mental aspects of it that you're going through still?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very proud of myself for where I am and what I've been through. And a lot of people go to treatment and they do great, and relapse is just really, really common, unfortunately. And I feel very lucky that I've been able to have the treatment team that I have had and have to continue to do well. For me, it's, you know, my recovery and what I deal with emotionally and why I think I've maintained recovery is, first of all, how important it is to me, and just I have big things I want to do in this life, and I realized how important it is to live and be happy, and I have a great family and a great boyfriend, and if I have an eating disorder, first of all, I'll either be isolated and in this prison or I'll be dead. So it's kind of picking mm-hmm. to live. And again, for me, it's about living life is more important than whatever I weigh or whatever my body looks like. It's been learning to not be so angry with my body, but love it for what it allows me to do, just to walk, to one day be able to have a child. It's about really learning to love who you are and love your body. And some days are better than others. It's not to say that I look in the mirror and I'm like, yeah, I look great all the time.
You'd be one of very few who did that.
Yeah, exactly. Like, wow, I'm looking hot. So it's definitely not that, but it's just about when the adversarial voice comes in, being able to not listen to it and really choose to, you know, be more positive in the world in general.
I think that's really great, and thank you for sharing all of that. I think that's a lot of really good lessons that the listeners and I personally would love to take with myself. I think not just body image, but self-esteem in general is so important just to being successful in this life and in the young adult life, what this whole podcast is about. So I think it's important for the listeners to hear that some success stories and that you've really beaten something that was really difficult. It's really great to hear success stories. And that's a lot of the reason why I started this whole podcast, was to hear stories like yours shared. And I think it's going to be great for the listeners to hear as well. So I know that you are, to transition, and this is a horrible segue. I know that you are in grad school and you are working to get your hours to in order to graduate, but you've also had a few other jobs post
college.
And I'd love to talk about those a little bit. You worked at Rustico, which is a nice restaurant.
Yeah, and the food is delicious, and it didn't help my recovery eating pasta every day, I have to say that.
I do the same. I eat a lot of pasta myself, and I just tell myself, hey, it's fine.
You only live once. You got to eat as much pasta as you can live in this lifetime.
There we go, listeners. If you could take anything from this episode, eat pasta.
Yes. I did work at Rustico. I've actually worked at Rustico a few times. That was my first job when I was 16. I was a hostess there in high school.
I think I remember that.
Yeah, not for very long. It was a lot to handle when you're 16.
I think my sister actually has that job.
Yeah, she was actually there when I was there recently. But I don't think she's there anymore. She was there for like a second.
I don't know. She's a 16, 17-year-old high school girl. She doesn't tell her older brother anything.
Yeah, she just does what she does.
It's one of those relationships.
Yeah. But yeah, she was there. I do remember that this past summer. So I was there when I was 16, and then I was there, 2 years ago, I went back as a server for a couple months, and then when I graduated this past May, I went back there again, and I was there over summer, and I was planning to continue through grad school, but I ended up leaving kind of a month into grad school, because it was too much to do both.
I've had people who, on this show, who have been waiters or waitresses, servers, before, and it seems like, in general, the reputation of it is largely negative. Sometimes people always say, oh, I hate my job, blah, blah, blah. But it seems that it's actually kind of fun sometimes.
Yeah, it can be a ton of fun, and it's great money. Like, at our age, right out of school, there's pretty much that's where you can make the most money. It's just you can't kind of grow from there. So it's great money. It can be fun, but it can be really hard. People can be really mean. And that's what I'm so sensitive, and I take things so personally. And, you know, if I made a mistake or if whatever happened and people got mad, I would like carry it with me for like a week. And it's about food.
Yeah. And it was like one customer one day that
I'm like, oh my God, they're right. I'm horrible. But it was great. It was great for what I needed at the time, and I saved money, which was great. It's tough. It definitely gets a bad rap, but if you need to do it, then it's a great thing to do.
Yeah, I definitely respect people who do it, and I like you said, it is pretty good money. It seems like it could be fun to meet people, and it's definitely a life skill that, can't hurt you to be able to deal with difficult people in certain, situations like that.
I think I learned more in my time working at I worked at Nordstrom as well for a few years, and I think I learned more working at Nordstrom and Rustico than I could have learned in any other place in my life, just about people, how to think quickly, and, I learned a lot in those jobs.
I was never a server per se, but I did work at a golf course for a little bit, which is a service industry. Although people at golf courses in general, I don't want to compare them to restaurants. I'm going to get a lot of heat from that comment on the show. But I did work at a bakery for a little bit. And so that is something I can kind of relate to. Although people aren't nearly as testy about their coffee as they are about their alcohol. Actually, never mind. I take that back. Yeah. People are very into their coffee.
They are. It's true.
I didn't even start drinking coffee until college, and I still don't drink a whole lot. But
I love coffee. It's I don't know what I would do without coffee.
Are you an all day drinker or just a morning drinker?
just a morning drinker, and I'm not that I don't drink it for the caffeine, I don't think. I just like when I wake up in the morning, I'm like, today's a good day because I'm gonna drink coffee right now. You know, I just love like the whole like ritual of it, and I just, yeah, but I only drink one cup, or otherwise I'll be like pretty crazy all day.
Wow, that I have a lot of respect for that, because I don't drink coffee every day. But when I do, I just drink like a really big cup, and I go back for refills. And I don't know, maybe that's why my hands shake sometimes.
Yeah,
I probably shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
That's a joke, Mom. So you also mentioned Nordstrom's.
Yeah.
I feel like that might not be as fast-paced as a restaurant, but it certainly could be stressful because you're dealing with, you know, people who want things really quickly at the same time, right? And want help immediately when they want it. How did that kind of relate to working in a restaurant? And do you have any good stories about that?
Oh, man. I have bad stories. I don't know about good stories.
Oh, wow.
Nordstrom, I mean, I don't want to, like, talk bad about Nordstrom, you know. But it was great also good money. So Nordstrom, you make only commission. I worked in the shoe department, so you don't make an hourly pay or an hourly wage. It's only what you sell. So when people return things, that gets taken out of your paycheck.
Okay.
So everything is personal. Every shoe that someone does or does not buy, mm-hmm. you feel it in your heart.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was tough. It's like a very competitive environment because people have families that they need to, you know, take care of. And there were just some mean, mean customers. Like, I'm trying to remember any story I have. I can't think of any right now. But there's just, yeah, people who are just, it's a busy, busy, busy floor and we don't have enough people. And customers are just like, why is there nobody here? And I'm like, I'm helping six people. I don't know what I can do. And Nordstrom's kind of all about customer service. So it's about maintaining a smile on your face and just being like, I kind of want to kill you, but here you go.
You don't have to worry about talking badly about Nordstrom's. This podcast is sponsored by Macy's.
Yeah, great.
But yeah, it kind of just, you want to just tell people like, chill out, you know?
Yeah, come on, it's shoes.
Right, you're not saving. We say this all the time in the radio business when people get stressed, because radio's, you know, instant, right? We can get a commercial on air really quickly. The turnaround's, you know, not that bad at all. Uh-huh. And so if we have something to correct, people are, you know, get really frantic, and, you know, some voices are sometimes raised around the stations and stuff. But we at the end of the day, we always say it's all right if you mess up, because we're not saving people's lives here, right?
Right. That's doctors.
We're not doctors, right? We're not you know, dealing with life or death. It's
exactly.
A radio commercial. It's a shoe at Nordstrom's, right? And so
yeah.
Sometimes you just want to tell people like, we'll get it done, right?
It's gonna be okay. I really believe that every person should have to work in either the retail or food industry. I think the world would be a better place if everyone did that job at some point.
Oh, I always like asking this to people who have waited tables before. Are you a really good tipper?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, I can't even tell you how many. Restico, I had parties of like 20 something people. And then they would leave me an 8% tip.
Oh, my God. That's painful.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, I can't even. It's so painful to even talk about, man.
and not to like sound entitled at all, but come on. Like,
I mean, I know that I didn't do anything horribly wrong. It was just that's how they tip. And there's nothing I could have done. But, yeah, I think that if you work as a server, you definitely become a lifelong good tipper. Even if I have a bad server, it's like, okay, they are having a bad day, or they have too many tables right now. Like, just give them the benefit of the doubt. Like, they're here, they're doing it. Just give them the 20%.
Are you critical of servers that you have, or you know, just because you judge it yourself? Like, I guess, like, for example, I used to be like an improviser, a comedy improviser in high school and college, and in no way am I the best improviser out there, right? I was okay for a college your basic college improviser. But when I watch improv, I'm just so critical of it because I used to do it. Do you kind of do the same thing with the activities that you used to work in?
Yeah, for sure. I definitely do. I get, like, my boyfriend is always like, why, like, they let them do their thing. I'm like, yeah, but they're doing it wrong. Like, I know. Like, especially if I go, like, shoe shopping, I'm like, they're doing it totally wrong. They're selling it wrong. Yeah, I definitely do that with any job I've had. Or even when I look at kids who are in high school, I always say, like, when I have kids one day, I'm going to tell them, you know, to work hard and do their best, but don't be like a crazy person in high school like I was. But I'll even see, like, my little sister, she's my stepsister, and she's a sophomore in high school. And I'm like, mm-hmm. You're doing it wrong. Like, these are the classes you should be taking, and I definitely do that.
Yeah, that's, I'm kind of like that way with my sisters, but I always try to be the cool big brother, because I've been gone for so long.
Right,
and
yeah.
I know that if I wasn't, then they would just hate me, and it'd be very easy to hate me, because they would never have to see me. But anyways... After you did go through your treatment, you mm-hmm. did finish your undergraduate degree.
Yeah, it took me a while. Well, it took me 5 years, but I did it very, very fast. So I took those 8 months off for treatment, and then I tried to go back to school. I went to community college, Moore Park College, but it was kind of tough, so I kept dropping classes. I did that for about a year and a half or 2 years. And then I finally kind of got it together, did a couple semesters at Moore Park, and then I transferred to Cal Lutheran, which is where I am now. And I finished there in a year and a half, so...
pretty quickly, all in
yeah.
all.
Yeah, I was taking like 22 units a semester. It was pretty crazy.
Wow. The most yeah. I ever took at TCU was 18.
Which is still a lot.
Yeah, no, yeah. It was a lot, and I graduated in 4 years on the dot, but...
Yeah, I didn't want to be more than 5 years behind, which I guess it's not a race and it doesn't matter, but I just kind of wanted to get moving on my life. So, yeah, I graduated from Cal Lutheran in May, and then I started grad school this past August.
Okay, and what is your timeline for graduating from high school? I know you went over your hours that you're going to have to do your 300 and then 2,000 afterwards. Did I have those numbers right?
Yeah. Well, no, sorry. It's, I think, a couple hundred while I'm in school, and then 3,000 altogether.
3,000 altogether.
Yeah.
What's your timeline to finish all of this school in hours? And are you going to be a doctor after all this?
I'm not. I wish. I wish. I will just be normal old Danielle, but maybe later on in life I'll go back and get my doctorate degree just so I can be Dr. Danielle. But I will graduate, I'll actually walk for graduating in May, so a year from now, but I'll actually be done in August. So after I graduate, I'll still have a couple classes to do because it's 2 full years, mm-hmm. the program. And then the hours usually take at least 2 years, so I hope to do them in 2 years and then kind of get my life started because I'm ready to do that.
Right, exactly. Well, that's usually my first general question is, what are your general emotions, fears, and excitements upon graduation? Now, all of my guests so far have graduated and then gone on to try to work. But I've definitely wanted to do episodes with young adults who are in grad school mm-hmm. because that's just another way that a lot of people choose to do their early 20s and mid-20s. So
right.
Kind of what were your thoughts when you got your undergraduate degree? Did you know you were going to go into grad school immediately? And kind of what were your thoughts and emotions behind all of that?
Yeah, I mean, I applied very late to grad school because I wasn't entirely sure, do I want to do this? Do I want to do it right away? Do I want to do this program? At first, I thought maybe I just want to be like a school counselor or like a guidance counselor. And then I thought maybe I don't want to go to grad school at all. So I didn't really know. So I don't think I even got in until after I graduated. So it all happened kind of quick. But when I graduated, I was really happy because kind of, as I've mentioned, college was a very difficult time just all around the whole time. It was just tough. And I felt so proud to accomplish, you know, to actually get my degree and do that and finish and feel like I can move on and accomplish things. So I was really, really happy. I was definitely nervous about starting grad school, especially going right in with no break, which has been tough. You know, I'm a little burnt out and I still have a while to go.
Sure.
But yeah, it was a really exciting time for me. I wasn't too afraid because I wasn't really going into the real world yet, I guess.
Right. That was something that I was maybe a little stubborn on in terms of not really considering grad school. Was at the end of my 4 years at TCU, even my whole senior year, I was so ready to get out into the real world and get a job and start working like adults are supposed to do or whatever, right?
Right.
And in retrospect, I might have enjoyed going to grad school, and yeah, it's not something that's completely off the table for the future. Yeah. Right? That is a whole nother path that some people go work for a few years and then they go back to school. And I'm definitely open to that possibility. But I've always just, I like hearing kind of your thoughts, you know, about choosing to do that rather than get a job. Do you have a specific reason of why you chose to do that instead of, you know, try to get a job? Is this something that you knew you wanted to do, this family therapy stuff? And so you knew you had to do this.
Well, I knew that I wanted, especially, I was kind of just afraid to apply to this program. And then once I decided to, I was very committed to and excited about it. And I knew that I really wanted to work with eating disorders, to be a therapist for people who are struggling. And I just knew that this would be the kind of journey I would have to take to do that. And I just figured, why wait? I'm going to end up going back anyways, and then I'm going to wish I would have done it earlier. So just do it, get it out of the way. And I'm enjoying it. It's really, really hard, but I'm definitely enjoying it, and I'm learning a lot. And it's just getting me closer to what I want to do, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Earlier in this podcast, you mentioned that you are living at home. So Cal Lutheran is relatively close. What's the commute to get to work and in school?
Well, to get to school is only about 15 or 20 minutes. But Blake lives in Brentwood, my boyfriend. And so I try and spend as much time there as I can. So I've definitely been commuting, and then we're probably going to move in together coming this next fall. So then I'll be commuting quite a bit.
Is that breaking news? Am I breaking news on this podcast? Is this?
Yeah, breaking news.
So living at home, you obviously have one fantastic perk in that you don't pay rent. Budgeting in the young adult life is still very difficult. Do you have any ideas and thoughts about budgeting that you kind of employ to save money in your everyday life, and apart from rent, because that's just kind of a fixed cost once you do move out, but there's nothing you can do about that. Maybe something else that you do to, you know, save money.
Yeah, budgeting's so hard. I think that's one of the hardest parts of this part of our life, is where, you know, especially if you're at home, you're like half an adult, half not. I want to be. So I try and save money where I can so that I feel a little bit more like I'm not still relying on my parents. I'm really lucky that my parents helped me, but I just got a Prius, so that helps with gas. Yes, I had like an SUV up until now, and I decided I can't drive that anymore because it's just too expensive. So I made a responsible choice, and now I love my Prius.
All my Texas listeners are cringing right now.
I know, I'm sorry.
No, that's a joke. I like making fun of Texas because I'm from California, but I love Texas.
Yeah, I know. I should have like a truck or something. But I have my Prius and I love it. And I try to, you know, pack lunches. I go to school at night, so I pack dinners so I don't have to spend money on food. And I just, you know, I save where I can. I don't buy new stuff whenever I can avoid it. And I kind of naturally live kind of simply. I really don't like to spend money. Mm-hmm. I'm just, I guess, a natural saver, which is a good thing and a bad thing at times. But yeah, I just try and like cut costs where I can, and it'll be different once I move out, I guess.
How do you go about making friends in grad school? Have you made a lot of friends with the people that you go to school with, or do you keep in touch with other people that maybe were old friends from high school since you are in the area?
Right. Yeah, both. you know, I feel like I have a really great group of friends from high school, which is funny because they're not friends that I was friends with in high school. We became friends after high school. They just happened to be from the same high school. That's a great group of friends. And then I have made great friends in grad school. It's funny, a couple people who went to Oak Park High School are in my program. So I've become a lot closer with them. And the thing with my program is there's a lot of people who are older, people who already have kids and families. And it's actually been really cool and interesting to become friends with people who are in a different part of their lives. There's one woman in the program who's she's almost 70, and she's like a great friend of mine, which has been so kind of cool to make a friend who has so much life experience that she can share with me, you know?
Yeah, that is really great that you're kind of seeing people in different stages of their lives that still want to do the same thing that you want to do.
Right.
And so it's cool to make friendships that way. You've kind of talked about your future goals of what you want to do in your career, but do you have just ideas for your future in terms of 6-month, maybe 5-year, 10-year plans, anything like that?
Yeah, I'm a big planner. 6 months, I'll be doing what I'm doing now. Hopefully, I'll know more about this whole thing than I do now. 5 years, I hope to be married in 5 years. Let me think. I'm 20. Almost
breaking
24.
News. Are we breaking news on this podcast again?
No. Okay. Blake and I joke about it all the time. I'm like, so a ring. But no, not yet. First, we want to live together.
Sure.
So that'll be coming in the near-ish future. So I definitely want to be married. I definitely want to have kids. That's something I've always imagined myself as a mom. I'm excited about that. I don't want it to be yet, but I do want it to happen. And then in terms of my career, I would love to work in an eating disorder treatment facility. I'll work my way up, be a clinical director, and then hopefully one day either open up my own treatment center or have a private practice where I specialize in eating disorders based on the knowledge I've accrued.
Do you think that you have kind of taken a little bit of a bright side of what has happened to you in terms of that is what you're passionate about and what you really want to commit your life to helping people?
Yeah, I am actually very thankful for my whole experience. I mean, it was horrible and has been horrible, but it's created a path for me, and I feel like I have meaning and purpose and I know what I want to do. And I think, you know, it's really great that I'll be able to help people with a disease I know so intimately. And in my own experience, it helps a lot when you're being treated by someone who has struggled with an eating disorder themselves. Not to say that if you haven't, you can't be a good therapist. But I'm very thankful for my whole experience. And it's also just made me a better version of myself. I know how fragile life can be, and I'm still a perfectionist, but I try and work on that part of myself to just let things happen as they will, you know?
Yeah, that is a great attitude to have. And I think it is good to have 5-year, 10-year plans. I don't really. And I've talked about this a little bit on the show. I kind of look at my life in terms of 6-month projects and just reevaluating every 6 months and seeing, all right, what can I do differently over these next 6 months that will just make my life more enjoyable and happy? Kind of reevaluating from there. And
yeah, that's a good way to look at it, because 6 months is not an overwhelming amount of time. So you just kind of go 6 months at a time, and yeah. I like that idea.
Yeah, that's just one of the little projects that I like to throw out there for the listeners who want to try that. Yeah. I have a couple of fun questions, actually, now. What color crayon would you be and why?
So I really like the color periwinkle. Crayola.
What is that?
Periwinkle? You don't remember the Crayola crayons? They all had, like, cool names.
Sure.
No? Okay, well, one was called periwinkle, and it was, like, bluish purple. Since I was a little girl, I really liked it. And so that would probably be the color that I would be, because I'd like it. I don't have a good reason, I guess.
I like that answer, though.
Go with it.
What would you do if you won the lottery tomorrow?
Oh, man, that would be great.
Right?
And yeah.
I always need to specify, you're winning an amount of money you cannot spend. It's $100 million.
Okay. Honestly, I would continue school, finish, still do what I'm doing, but maybe my whole time, like the time that I take to do it might be not as long, because I could get my hours and then open up my own treatment facility with all the money I have right away. I would buy a house and I would travel, and I would definitely help people in any way that I could. I don't want to just say, you know, donate money in general, because that's kind of a cliche thing to do. So I'd probably have some sort of passion project where I could use the money to help people in a more kind of specific way. I don't know what it would be. But yeah, I feel like I would just continue to live my life in the way I want it to be, but it's just like more in a more easy way and more extravagantly.
I think a lot of people end up answering that question in a similar way. I always am waiting for somebody to say that they would quit their job or quit school, and I haven't gotten anybody to say that. And it's something that I think about. If I won $100 million, I'm not sure that I would really quit my job either, but I certainly would maybe make an investment of some sorts that would really speed up my career, right?
You know,
I work in radio, I could probably buy a radio station, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of what I was trying to say before. Yeah.
Right. So, I don't know. I think that's a really fun question, and it makes me sad that I don't have $100 million.
I know. That would just be great.
But I've talked with other guests on this podcast that not having a lot of money is kind of a life experience that is necessary for young adults, right? If you're making, you know, six figures right out of college, that's you're missing a large part of life. Now, I need to specify, if you can make six figures right out of college, go do it.
I'm not
telling you not to.
Yeah.
But if you don't, like 99.9% of college graduates, it's okay.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's. I feel like you appreciate it more once you do start making more money, because you know where you've been.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. You know where you've been.
Yeah.
What do you do in your free time, if you have any?
I do and I don't, because I'm not working right now till I start in August. So I do a lot of writing of papers. And then in my free time, I watch a lot of Netflix.
What are you watching right now?
Well, I just finished all of Grey's Anatomy, which was kind of an unhealthy addiction, I have to be honest. It was really bad.
It was a multiple episodes every day kind of binge.
Oh, yeah. It was like a 6-month project that I actually feel proud of accomplishing.
I've never seen it, but I do know it.
You know, I really loved it, I have to say. People talk badly about it, but I just loved it. So I do that. I try and exercise. You know, I'm not one of those avid exercisers, but it definitely makes me feel better, so I try to do that when I can. I love to spend time with Blake and my family. I have two little cousins who I love to be with. I'm a big family and friends person, so...
Yeah, somebody's got to spend time with Blake, so...
I know, right? You gotta give him company somehow.
You're nice enough to grant him a few hours here and there.
Right.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how intolerable do you find baby pics on Facebook?
I love baby pics. So is one intolerable?
One means you love them.
I'm going to go with like a one.
Wow.
I know.
That's the best answer. It seems the answer, and I'm totally throwing out a generalization, but all the guys on this podcast seem to answer a little higher than the women that I have on this podcast have.
Yeah.
Although our mutual friend Claire Adams, when she was on the show, said it all depends on how her hormones are on that day. It could fluctuate between a 2 and an 8, I think she said. So
that was a good point.
So
yeah, I just love babies. I really do.
Well, I always follow up with this question. What about engagement pictures?
You know, those I don't know how I feel about, because on the one hand, I'm very happy for everyone. On the other hand, Like, I would love to be engaged. Not at this moment, but at some
breaking
point.
News? Breaking news?
No, still no. So, I mean, I'm looking forward to that part of my life. For me, it's more just weird, like, how many people are getting engaged and how every time I open my Facebook, a new person from high school is engaged or married or
right.
has a child. And I'm like, whoa, when, like, I'm 16. When did that happen, you know? So, yeah, I guess that's how I feel. I guess I just feel like it's weird.
That's how I feel this. You really date yourself when you, like, you look at people getting engaged. And I, like you said, like, so much of me feels like a high school kid still. So much of me feels like a college kid still. And then I do have a part of me that's like, all right, I'm 24. I turned 25 in 6 months. I've got to, you know, have my career set. But I kind of outline this to my mom all the time. Mm-hmm. If I were to meet my soulmate tomorrow, which is unlikely, but say I did.
You never know.
That's at least 2 to 3 years of dating.
Right.
And then a year or so of engagement. So I'm about 4 years off if I met my soulmate tomorrow.
Right.
Give me 2 years approximately to make a girlfriend. That takes me to 30 right there to get married. So when I see engagement photos on Facebook, that just, I'm like, man, I am really far away from that. Like,
right.
And you do have a boyfriend of 8 years, so you're a little closer than I am. But I really do kind of just look at myself when I see those photos a lot and just like, but I'm okay with it. I'm really okay with it. I should put that out there. It's just, man, that's not me.
Yeah. I feel like we have this kind of sort of timeline for ourselves where, oh, when we're 25, we should start thinking about, you know, who we're going to be with. And there's this set timeline that kind of society sets for us, but it's really just arbitrary and everyone, you know, has their own journey and meets people at different times. And these days people are having kids later and later and it's fine and safe. And so it doesn't really matter.
Absolutely. Like you mentioned, I recently had an episode with two mutual friends of mine who got married at age 23. You know, they knew each other for a few years in college and got married approximately a year and a half out of college. You know, they are, you know, doing very well, obviously, and they're going to be fantastic. But it's just a different style that a lot of people go for. And I think this is really when, you know, people are different in high school and people are different in college just in terms of what you're interested in. But really, once you graduate and move into the young adult life, that's when we really start separating ourselves. And maybe that's kind of where people feel a little lonely sometimes.
Yeah.
Right?
For sure.
Because you're just at different places in your life.
Yeah.
I just think that's really interesting, and that's always something fun to talk about.
Yeah.
What person has inspired you the most to be successful throughout your young adult life, and that might have changed through the years too?
Yeah, that's a good question. I feel like I've always wanted to, just my parents in general, not because they were not actually at all the parents who pushed me really hard or told me I had to do any, I was very independent, but I've always wanted to do them proud. And I feel like it's such a great feeling when you feel like you've done your parents proud. Them and also Blake. I just, you know, my relationship with Blake has been so great, and I always just want to be my best for him, and I've always imagined our life together, and so I always just want to make sure that that I always take care of myself, and I guess I just want to be successful not only just in career but just as a person, you know, for our life together and for him, because I like when he's proud of me, I guess. That sounds weird. I don't know.
No, I think that's completely normal to want to make not only your parents proud, but your significant other proud as well. I personally don't have a significant other, but I have in the past, and so I can definitely relate to that. And I always, when I answer this question, I tend to say my parents, but really it comes down to my siblings. My two little sisters are who I most want to be successful for. And you know, because they're both younger than me, and you're an older, you're the oldest sibling as well, just like I am.
Yeah.
And so you probably feel the same thing as me, but you kind of feel a duty to be successful, to set an example for your younger siblings. It's something that I've always felt, and it's not a burden in any way.
No,
it's just something that I, that older siblings really want to do for their younger siblings.
Yeah, for sure. It's actually an issue with me and my little sister because I'm always trying to, you know, do that for her, and I always want to push her, and she's always like, just be my friend, don't be my like mentor. And I'm like, but I want to be.
I feel like that's how Maris and Lily are, my two younger sisters. But
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would you write a book on outside of your career? So it can't be psychology.
Right. I would write a book like two parents talking about the transition from high school to college, because I don't think that it's talked about enough. And I think that you go into college, like kind of you've talked about, you know, in the purpose of this podcast, you know, college is the best 4 years of your life. And it definitely can be and is for many people, but it also can not be. And it can be a big transition and a big disappointment if you think it's going to be and it's not what you thought. And I just think that there needs to be more awareness that kids are 18 when they go to college and it's going to be tough. And I don't know, I guess just making more awareness about that, just the transition around that.
Yeah. I think that'd be a really great book to read, and it'd be a really important kind of for kids going into college to maybe look in retrospect on, you know, that this is really important to go off to college, but it's not the end all be all necessarily. I think just to kind of relate that to graduating college and moving into the young adult life, I definitely want to have some adults on this pod, and not that we are adults, right? But some real grown-ups, right?
Yeah.
On this podcast someday, because I think that'll be really important for the listeners to hear that it's that some of the things we might think are a big deal now at age 23 to 25 might not be a big deal at age 45, right?
Yeah. I guess that's a theme of life.
Right, how we look at high school, like you mentioned, you thought you know, everything was the biggest deal in high school, but was it really when you look back?
Right. Yeah. No. And that's how it always is. It always feels so intense and in the moment, and then you look back and you're like, oh, that wasn't even a big deal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I totally agree. Do you believe at all in sacrificing happiness to get ahead in life? Maybe little sacrifices?
I really don't. I mean, I feel like I feel like I should say, I guess, yeah, little sacrifices, but I really don't believe that. I think that the most important thing is to feel happy. And if you don't feel happy, then nothing else matters. All the success in the world doesn't matter. And for me, that's all I want, is I want to feel content and happy and fulfilled, and nothing else matters, I don't think.
I think that word that you used, fulfillment, is so important. Because I like to talk about on the show fulfillment versus achievement.
Yeah.
People who achieve a lot of things don't necessarily have fulfillment in their lives. And so they keep striving and striving and striving. And they might be successful on the outside, but if you don't feel fulfilled inside, then what's it all really worth, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Really do what they want to do in life. And that doesn't necessarily need to be career related. That could be family oriented. It could be relationship oriented, whatever it is. But whatever makes you feel, you know, we talk so much about you got to work hard and make sacrifices and, you know, get a little bloody and dirty out here, right? But you also need to, in the end, do what makes you happy, man, right?
Yeah, it's exactly.
It's such a hippie idea.
No, it's true, though. It's so true, because you can achieve, like you said, everything in the world and everything you ever imagined, but if you're not happy, it won't feel like an achievement at all. And that's kind of why I'm going into the field I'm going to, because I feel like every day will be fulfilling, and I feel like I'll really be, like, I have a purpose, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I totally started this podcast for myself, right?
Yeah.
I started this because I wanted to help myself and grow myself. But the feedback that I get from people is so rewarding. So I'm not going to be a psychologist myself, but I can relate to what you are feeling and your ideas behind that.
Yeah, and what you're doing is actually very much like a, you know, therapist, you know, asking people about their life, and you're pretty much doing therapy right now.
It's very cathartic, right?
Yeah.
For my guests always say that after the show, whenever we stop recording, they always tell me, "Oh man, that was great. I feel so light now." And
yeah,
I got the,
yeah.
It's an hour or so for me and my guests to vent about how much real life kind of stinks sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. It's great.
So what should you start, stop, and keep doing to become the person you want to be?
I would say I should stop trying to, I guess, you know, be perfect in everything and get, whether it's with school, trying to get the best grades, which don't even matter at this point, or just in everything, just to stop trying to, like, be so perfect and just do the best I can and be okay with that. I think that would be really important for me. I think I should keep following, you know, my passion and, like we kind of just talked about, pick fulfillment over achievement and choose to be happy and do things that make me happy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I should start, I feel like a part of my life that I should start working on is kind of the more social aspects. And like I mentioned, I do have great friends and I love them and I have a great time with them, but I'm not the best at staying in touch or getting together with people. I often just like don't answer text messages. So I think I should start making a better effort in doing that for my whole life, because friends are who you always need around, and a support, you know, a support system and a whole network of people around you who love you. So I need to start taking better advantage of that.
I think you really hit it right on the head there, and that's a really great note to end on. So thank you so much for being on this podcast. Do you have any parting message that you'd like the listeners to kind of take away from what we've talked about this evening?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would just say that, you know, this time of our life is confusing and tough, but it's great and we're learning a lot and we're all going through it together, this young adulthood, you know, time of life. And yeah, I would just say to everyone to really focus on what makes them happy and don't get so lost in making money and following a certain timeline. And yeah, I mean, I guess I have a lot of life still to live, so I don't have that much wisdom to give, but that would be what I have so far.
Well, I think your story is very inspiring, and that's a perfect note to end on. So thank you so much, Danielle, for being on this podcast. Now, if anybody has any questions for you after this episode, and sometimes the guests do get questions,
yeah.
Where can they reach you?
Probably Facebook would be the best place. It's just my name, Danielle Beckerman. Yeah, that would probably be the easiest place.
Awesome. Okay, well, thank you again, and thank you, listeners, for listening to this episode. I will talk to you next week.